Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for April 5th, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. First up tonight, at about 10 minutes after the hour, Peter Eisner, co-author of the book The Italian Letter, How the Bush Administration Used a Fake Letter to Build the Case for War in Iraq. Peter Eisner, co-author of this book with Newt Royce, just published by Rodale Books, which I thought was known for health, seems to be branching out. And then at the bottom of the hour, we will be hearing from Julia Vitula Martin, who is, well, certainly not the most common affiliation on WBAI's airways, a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and an author of an op-ed in the New York Post yesterday about Columbia University's imperialist moves into redeveloping Harlem. And one of these strange sort of left-right coincidences of interest is resistance to eminent domain, the use of state power to promote the private interests of developers. And we will talk to her about Columbia and eminent domain issues and the redevelopment of Harlem. And speaking of Columbia University, here's something good that is coming out of there. Next Wednesday, come hear a trio of elite economists discussing global warming. Columbia University's Committee on Global Thought is sponsoring a discussion with Nicholas Stern, who is with the Cabinet Office of the British Treasury, about his 2006 publication, The Stern Review of the Economics of Climate Change. It was a 700-page report, which published by the British government last October, which was quite influential in elite circles. Stern introducing the idea into elite discourse that, well, you usually hear that the cost of doing something about climate change was too great, so we just had to carry on with the way things we were in court catastrophe. Stern introduced the idea to elite discourse that doing nothing about climate change would actually cost a lot of money because pandemics and flooding cities and failing crops will actually hurt economic growth. Although I'm not sure that's the main reason to be concerned about global warming, but that's the way you have to talk to economists. Stern will be joined by two other elite economists, Jeffrey Sachs, who is the director of Columbia University's Earth Institute, which is an attempt to bring together not only economists, but a whole variety of social scientists, earth scientists, to talk about issues of development and sustainability. And then he will also be joined by Joseph Stiglitz, who is a university professor at Columbia and 2001 Nobel laureate in economics, who's been on this show a couple of times, actually. I will be recording this and presenting highlights on my show 2 weeks from now. But come hear the live event if you want the full effect. This will be held next Wednesday, April 11th at 4 p.m., Teachers College, Columbia University, in the Horace Mann Building, 147 Horace Mann Building, which is at 525 West 120th Street between Broadway and Amsterdam. Again, that's at the Horace Mann Building, room 147, which is 525 West 120th Street between Broadway and Amsterdam. That's April 11th, next Wednesday at 4 p.m., Nicholas Stern, Jeffrey Sachs, Joseph Stiglitz. Instead of looking at the recent economic headlines, I thought I'd open with a longer-term view of an often mysterious topic, productivity. Productivity is the word economists use to describe how much output workers can create in an hour of labor. While that sounds conceptually simple, it's really not all that easy to measure in practice. What is the output of a lawyer, for example, a nurse? It's kind of hard to say. Economists try to finesse these issues by measuring output in dollars adjusted for inflation. And while that may sound fairly straightforward, it's actually not. For more on the complexities of all this, see my most recent book, After the New Economy. But let's leave aside all those problems for now. Productivity is important, however exactly you measure it, because it sets an upper limit on a society's material well-being. I say upper limit because a lot depends upon how that output is distributed. Sometimes workers get wage increases that reflect improvements in their productivity, and sometimes they don't. And managers and shareholders capture all the gains. But when productivity growth is weak, no one really wins. The stagflation, the slow growth and rising inflation of the 1970s, which came with declining real wages, was a byproduct of the massive slowdown in productivity growth that began in the late 60s and extended into the early 1990s. That slowdown ended around 1995. Most economists agree that rising investments in high-tech computer and communications equipment was responsible for the acceleration in productivity in the late 1990s, an acceleration that lasted into the early 2000s. In the late 1990s, most workers of all colors, genders, and pay scales enjoyed wage gains that outpaced inflation. That was the first episode of sustained broad real wage increases since the real wage peaked in 1973. Since 2000, however, real wages have trended flat to down, with only the upper brackets getting any kind of increases, and the very, very upper brackets hogging most of the gains in economic growth and productivity improvements. That even though productivity growth by some measures accelerated after the 2001 recession. And despite that, and that also occurred despite the fact that investment in high-tech equipment collapsed after the bursting of the dot-com bubble and has barely recovered since. So what's been happening? Why has productivity continued to rise despite that collapse in investment? Three economists associated with the Federal Reserve have a new paper that addresses this question. Stephen Olner and Daniel Sitchell of the Federal Reserve Board in Washington and Kevin Sturrow of the New York Federal Reserve, just around the corner from where I'm sitting. Since they're among the economists most noted for their studies of the 1990s acceleration, their work is especially interesting. Their findings are fairly technical, too technical for a radio show, but let me boil them down to some bare essentials. Olner, Sichel, and Sturrow confirmed their earlier findings that the late 1990s acceleration in productivity was the result of higher rates of investment in information technology, especially computer hardware. Software and communications equipment also contributed, but less so. That picture changes dramatically after 2000. Information technology's contribution actually turned negative, thanks to the investment collapse. Most of the post-2000 improvement in productivity can be attributed to less pleasant factors like massive cost-cutting and business reorganization, which is a polite way of saying layoffs and outsourcing. The authors buttress their argument by showing that some of the strongest productivity improvements in recent years have come from industries that showed the sharpest falls in profits in the 2001 recession. In other words, while the productivity acceleration of the 1990s made possible some real wage increases for ordinary workers, productivity growth since 2000 has come at the expense of the working class. Of course, Fed economists don't put it that way, but that's what I'm here for. Let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back to speak with Peter Eisner. And that one of the songs in the song cycle, Das Lied von der Erde by Gustav Mahler, performed in a beautiful, beautiful performance by the Ensemble Musik Oblique, conducted by Philipp Herwege, with Hans-Peter Blochwitz singing. That was Mahler's orchestral version, scaled down, rearranged for a chamber ensemble by Arnold Schoenberg. And this is I just discovered this recording, but it's really quite lovely, and we'll be hearing more from that later in the show. And now we're joined by Peter Eisner, who is the co-author, along with Knut Reuss, of The Italian Letter, How the Bush Administration Used a Fake Letter to Build a Case for War in Iraq. And this all turns around the famous 16 words in Bush's State of the Union address from 2002. The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. 16 words, which turned out to be massively untrue, but massively consequential. Welcome to Behind the News, Peter Eisner.
Thank you.
I was amazed in reading through this book to see some of these names. It's like a recurrence of some characters from the early 1980s. Michael Ledeen, Manuka Gorbanifar, Seize Me, the Italian intelligence agents. It's like the KGB plot to kill the Pope and the Iran-Contra all over again. Where were these guys hiding that they resurfaced almost 20 years later?
There is a group of people that are local, that are attached to the neoconservative movement who wax and wane according to the political winds in Washington, and certainly have some strong ability at this moment to participate in all sorts of interesting operations. Take a look at James Woolsey, the one-time CIA director, who 2 days after 9/11 went on television suggesting with absolutely no evidence that Iraq must have had something to do with it. And that really was the starting point for this book.
Well, then we had that nutcase Lori Milroy claiming that Iraq was behind the Oklahoma City bombing, too. So then another character from the 80s reappearing. Let's talk about this these 16 words, which trace their origin to an Italian journalist who got some leaked documents from a rather shady character. So tell us that story and how these documents entered circulation.
Well, we went back to the beginning of the story of how President Bush's 16 words came to be. And we started out speaking with an Italian journalist named Elisabetta Burba, working for the magazine Panorama in Milan. She, in October 2002, received a set of documents from a failed former Italian policeman, later working for Italian military intelligence, CISMI, who tried to sell them to her. These documents described a train of events in which Saddam Hussein supposedly had sought out and purchased 500 tons of what is said in the documents as, quote, pure uranium yearly from Niger, and in fact having shipped the first shipment from Niger to Iraq by the year 2000.
Now, I think I've seen replicas of this on the web, and it looked fake to me. And the logo of the Niger government looked like it was hand drawn. In these days of, you know, when it's easy to forge things, that seemed unusually crude. So I mean, a lot of this, on the face of it, was hard to believe, to put it mildly, right?
Certainly, from the first moment, Elisabeth de Burba had questions. She also knew that it was potentially a hot story if true. And she took that document and a number of other documents home, and she and her husband started finding, her husband being a history professor, started finding inconsistencies. But still, to put the story down, she talked to her editors, and they decided that she would go to Niger and check it out firsthand. Meanwhile, her editor, who happened to be close to Silvio Berlusconi, who in fact owns the magazine, said, you know what would be a great idea? Let's drop a set of the documents over to the U.S. Embassy and see if they can verify whether the documents are true or not. So the United States had heard versions of these documents, had seen even verbatim texts of them, but had never seen the actual documents until Elisabetta somewhat reluctantly, on orders, brought the documents over to the U.S. Embassy in Rome on October 9th, 2002. And the U.S. Embassy promptly shipped them on to Washington, and they fed the fires for the improbable concept that Saddam Hussein was looking for and, in fact, trying to buy uranium from Niger.
Well, it looks like, to some degree, the Italian government, or at least its intelligence agencies and its president, Berlusconi, was trying to push the U.S. towards war in Iraq. What was in it for the Italians?
What you have to look back to the antecedents of the letters, the Italian letter and the documents that went along with it, and also what Silvio Berlusconi was doing. In the days after 9/11, he sought a role for Italy in showing that it could be helpful to the United States, and he asked his intelligence people to look around for any material that might be helpful to the cause in fighting the war on terrorism, and within a few days, Italian intelligence gave the first note of the possibility of uranium sales to the CIA station in Rome, which asked for more information, and then got a fuller version that was delivered to President Bush, delivered to the Bush administration when Berlusconi visited President Bush in October, on October 15th, 2001, just a month after 9/11. So on Berlusconi's part, he was not even looking at the documents or designing anything. He just wanted to be in the good graces of the United States. For the part of CISMI, Italian intelligence, they were responding to an order. But at the same time, the forgery had to do with the inner workings of a very dysfunctional intelligence agency, as most of the rest of the intelligence community in the world know. As you mentioned, since the 1980s, all sorts of subplots going on, usually involving money. And there was a monetary incentive involving some rogue members of Italian intelligence that brought these letters to exist, finally.
And this guy who passed him along to the journalist, was he an agent of the intelligence agency, or is he just trying to pick up a few thousand euros?
The guy was a guy named Rocco Martino, an agent in the true sense of what an agent is. Agents in intelligence parlance are not working for the agency. He was a guy that they would pass along stuff to, use as an intermediary, use as a cutout. And in this case, he was certainly outside the tent, but he was being fed information by operatives inside CISMI who were purporting to be giving him material that was true. Elizabeth Berger thought that maybe even the documents, that he didn't realize the documents were false, but they were blatantly false, and he was out there kind of a ne'er-do-well, down-on-his-luck former policeman who was trying to make some bucks. He asked for about the equivalent of about $10,000 for these documents.
And as you point out, this is common in Italian journalism to pay for sources like that. So these documents, phony documents, enter the channels of the U.S. government, and what happened once they entered that machinery?
Even before the actual documents arrived, there's a very interesting and important moment. We have to remember that by the time she got the documents, Joseph Wilson had already gone to Niger and investigated the story. But the documents were already known to U.S. intelligence. In fact, one of them, a verbatim version of it, arrived at CIA headquarters on February 5th, 2002. A very important date, 1 week before Vice President Cheney received a report from the Defense Intelligence Agency saying that Iraq is in fact trying to buy uranium from Niger. And he went back to the CIA saying that your sources, you have to beat the bushes, get more information. You've been too laid back on this story. Here's this DIA report, which, in fact, DIA, of course, under Donald Rumsfeld, took the same information and just took out all the caveats that CIA was seeing in the document. CIA, as a result, being cajoled repeatedly by Vice President Cheney, said, "What do we do now? How do we get more information?" And then the suggestion came from Valerie Plame, that my husband could help. And then Joe Wilson was dispatched to Niger, where once again he showed that there was no substance to the report. But the interesting thing was that on February 5th, when a verbatim text of this this material arrived at CIA headquarters, it was so wrong, this particular document was so wrong, that any of us could have taken it, done a 15-minute Google check, and we would have found that it was naming the wrong members of the Niger Supreme Court, people that hadn't been on the Supreme Court for 17 years. These people supposedly were endorsing the decision to sell the uranium to Saddam Hussein. It even misnamed the Supreme Court, saying that it was the Court of State, which no longer existed. But the CIA, which already thought the report was so foolish, that didn't even bother to do a check on this document, but mostly because they thought that it was irrelevant to the larger question of dealing with weapons of mass destruction, if any.
I'm speaking with Peter Eisner, who is a co-author, along with Newt Rice, of The Italian Letter, How the Bush Administration Used a Fake Letter to Build a Case for War in Iraq, just out from Rodale Press. Well, you describe an administration where the president is almost a secondary figure, and it's Cheney who's running the show, wasn't it?
Well, here's the thing. We're still trying to analyze that relationship and also trying to psychoanalyze the relationship and the people themselves, and it's very hard to do. But here's my starting point. To this hour, Vice President Cheney and President Bush, regardless of who's in charge and what they believe, say that they acted based on the intelligence that they had received. And what could they do if the intelligence was bad and wrong? And parting from that point, we have to take a look at the intelligence they received and put it to the test. And when you do that, you find out that the intelligence they received was on many levels faulty, questioned, criticized within the Bush administration, criticized at the State Department, criticized at the CIA, until the Bush administration itself demanding information that would support the concept of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, forced high-level people to put pressure on low-level people to write the worst possible the worst case possible version of what this intelligence might mean if true. So there was an operation going on in the White House. It was a propaganda operation that started in the summer of 2002. The White House Iraq Group, which designed itself specifically to put raw material into the meat grinder and come out with a nice, neat loaf that could be sold both to the American public and to Congress.
Well, did the people at the highest levels know they were lying, or did they really believe this stuff?
The people that we spoke to were, in many cases, very close to Dick Cheney, people that had worked for Dick Cheney in other incarnations, like Pat Lang, the former key aide to Cheney when Cheney was Secretary of Defense, and who worked at the Defense Intelligence Agency. We quote Pat Lang as saying, this is not the Dick Cheney I know. This is a Dick Cheney who seems to be delusional. Now, and then talk to Lawrence Wilkerson, the former chief of staff of Colin Powell, saying he thinks that to this hour, Dick Cheney still thinks that there somewhere are buried weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, despite all the searches. So what did they believe? What did they want to believe? The information that they had, if they wanted to listen, was that there was raw intelligence. There are grave questions about it. And in particular, Cheney, who knew a lot about receiving intelligence material, what in the parlance is called a very good consumer of intelligence. He, unlike many others, including various congressional committees, saw that when the early information about the Niger uranium sale came in, that the information had come from SISMI, Italian intelligence. He knew very well that Italian intelligence was unreliable, that they did shoddy work. And if everyone had seen that it had been SISMI doing that operation, immediately there would be great questions raised. But few people knew that. So all we can do is suppose, and we can conjecture. We come to a point where a forthright and brave congressional committee with subpoena power might be able to start getting some answers. There were congressional hearings, certainly in 2003, 2004, 2005, but very politicized and very protective of the Bush administration. under a Republican majority.
What's the story behind Colin Powell's very damaging and devious but influential speech before the UN?
We talk about that quite a bit in the book with Lawrence Wilkerson, who one of the figures in this story, who has not written his own book, who is deeply troubled about his role and in the entire period of the march toward war. And
he's on the book cover saying, "Read the book and weep for our democracy."
Yes, he believes that he questions. He, for a long time, he thought believed the idea that Colin Powell is the good soldier and just wanted to follow orders, and he himself didn't have any damning information. He now wonders, what was Colin Powell's role? He certainly, Wilkerson, as chief of staff, certainly was very close to Colin Powell in the period between the 2003 State of the Union message and Powell's damaging and absolutely false statements before the United Nations in February of 2003. And he watched and participated in the conversations between CIA and State Department with George Tenet and George Tenet's aides over what should be included in this speech. And Wilkerson cannot fathom where the deception came in. He seemed to be seeing everybody that was dealing above board, and he asks himself what was happening that he himself didn't see. Was there a second tier operating that was beyond him? And he believes that he said famously that he thought that there was a cabal, that there was in fact a second tier operated by Cheney in the State Department, in the Defense Department, pushing, cajoling, and developing information that would be sellable toward convincing people that mushroom clouds were on the horizon unless the United States invaded Iraq. So the word on Powell is not yet known. You and I would need some sodium pentothal and some subpoenas to get close to that one.
Well, let's hope some people in Congress actually start deploying those things. We've only got a minute left or so, but this is the big question, and you've only got a minute to answer it. Why were they so hot to invade Iraq? I mean, why did they invent this stuff or delude themselves and the rest of us? Why were they so hot for this?
Well, famously, Don Rumsfeld, Vice President Cheney, Assistant Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz, Paul Wolfowitz, people inside the Defense Agency Office of Special Plans. It was peppered with a neoconservative group, often based in the American Enterprise Institute, which had a messianic idea that American-style democracy has to spread in the Middle East. Iraq was just as good as a start as any, almost just as good, because everybody was talking about Iran as being the real target, and it was an opportunity that people like James Woolsey saw hours after 9/11 to turn 9/11 into the start of that march toward American democracy in the Middle East. It's not rational, and it's not backed up. Today, or last night, President Bush said, "We've got to keep supporting the men in Iraq who are still in Iraq. If we leave, it'll be failure, and there could be another attack." So in 2007, President Bush is saying there could be another attack, implying that the first attack had something to do with Iraq, when it had the first attack, 9/11, which had nothing at all to do with Iraq, although it was sold that way.
Well, of course, as people receive that very differently now, his approval ratings are in the low 30s rather than the high 60s. All right, well, thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Peter Eisner, who a longtime Washington Post reporter and editor, who is the co-author, along with Newt Royce, of The Italian Letter, How the Bush Administration Used a Fake Letter to Build a Case for War in Iraq, just out from Rodale Books. And we'll be back after this station ID.
This is Quentin Crisp on WBAI in New York City. Oh.
on WBAI 99.5 FM. The Caldwell Chronicle is on the air. I'm Earl Caldwell. Tune in for our broadcast every Friday, 3 to 5 p.m., right here on listener-supported Pacifica Radio in New York City.
And we're back. This is WBAI, not only at 99.5 on your FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. The show is Behind the News, and my name is Doug Henwood. And before we get to the next segment, just a footnote to the previous one. I think the name Paul Wolfowitz came up in that interview, but there's an interesting scandal brewing at the World Bank, where its president, Iraq War architect and comb sucker Paul Wolfowitz, the comb sucker bit only makes sense if you've seen Fahrenheit 9/11. Wolfowitz has been caught in what looks like some very favorable treatment of his girlfriend. Last week, the Washington Post reported that Shaha Ali Riza, who is formerly a press person with the World Bank's Middle East and North Africa section, was shipped off to a job at the State Department with a huge salary increase to $193,000, considerably more than her boss, Condoleezza Rice, makes. She had to leave the bank's employ because the institution's rules prohibit her from working under someone she has a close personal relationship with. But that old softy Wolfowitz didn't want to throw her onto the street. He made sure she landed in a cushy gig. But even though she was working outside the building, her salary at the State Department still continued to be covered by the World Bank, a much higher salary than she was earning while she was in the bank's employ. The raise that she enjoyed was about twice what World Bank rules would have allowed for. You'd almost think there was some favoritism involved. The World Bank Staff Association circulated an internal memo yesterday of complaint about the matter, a copy of which someone passed along to me earlier today. The memo described, quote, a low level of staff trust in our human resource processes, largely because the rules are either ignored or applied unevenly. Quoting further, the case sends a message to staff that the rules apply to everyone except those associated with the most senior levels of management. It also sends the message to managers that they may flout the staff rules with impunity. It is extraordinarily discouraging to staff who have been denied promotions and or who receive a minimal salary increase despite stellar performance evaluations, and to hardworking staff whose entire annual salaries are less than Ms. Reese's promotion increase. This is not the first instance of such staff rule violations by the current World Bank Group management, and the Staff Association calls upon them to abide by and uphold the staff rules that govern all of us. Senior management has put forward a call for good governance both within the bank and among our partner countries. That's a pretty funny term, the people who borrow money from their partners. Good governance is founded in a respect for the rule of law, transparency, and accountability. In order to be credible, senior management must model the behavior it espouses. And that's the end of the quote from the Staff Association's memo. In other words, it seems that Wolfowitz can't do anything right. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to speak about Columbia University with Julia Vitullo-Martin. And then another excerpt from the songs that constitute Das Lied von der Erde, a song, symphonic song cycle by Gustav Mahler in a chamber arrangement by Arnold Schoenberg, performed by the Ensemble Musik Oblique, conducted by Philipp Herrwege and sung by Hans-Peter Blochwitz. Poems are based on some Chinese poems. And I know it's perverse of me, but I think German is a beautiful language, and it sounds very beautiful in those songs. And we'll hear a little bit more of that at the end of the show. And now we're joined by Julia Vitullo-Martin, who is a fellow with the Manhattan Institute, which is not an affiliation you hear often in these airways, but we do run a Catholic operation here in the small C sense. Welcome to WBAI, Julia Vatula Martin.
Thank you.
So you had a piece in the New York Post yesterday denouncing Columbia University for its greed in redeveloping Harlem, or what Columbia likes to call Manhattanville. First, just give us the basics on what is Columbia up to in its northern environs.
Well, first, the headline that the Post used about Columbia's greed, you know, that headline was chosen by the Post, not by me.
Well, they're not known for their subtlety at the Post.
Yes, yes. So essentially what's happening is Columbia University in Morningside Heights is a land-bound campus, and it desperately needs to expand, and it hit upon the idea of expanding northward into West Harlem or Manhattanville. Manhattanville, by the way, is a perfectly legitimate and really sort of wonderful old name for that neighborhood. West Harlem is as well, but they're not wrong, in my opinion, to use Manhattanville. In any event, they've been buying property in West Harlem for a very long time, about 25 years. And they've assembled most of the property that they need for what they're calling their new academic center. But some of the property they're not going to be able to get through usual private market transactions, so they are likely to ask the state of New York to take that property coercively under eminent domain. And my piece is about why I think that's objectionable. I think Columbia is right to expand, and I think it's going to be many elements of the plan are going to be good for the neighborhood.
Let's before we get into the details of Columbia's plans, let's talk about eminent domain law. This is something that a lot of folks on the right wing of the political spectrum have been exercised about for some time.
Actually, people on the entire range of the political spectrum have been exercised on this.
And New York State is, I think, has reputed to have some of the most developer-friendly and eminent domain law in the country. So tell us about eminent domain, the practice, and how it operates in New York City.
I'm hesitating a little bit here on your phrase, developer-friendly. What makes New York State's eminent domain law disturbing to many people, including to me, is that it's almost without restriction. And the worst cases of eminent domain, in my opinion, that have been used over the years have not been for private development. They have been for the state itself, and for state authorities to acquire property for rather questionable purposes. The private development comes in when a private entity of some kind wants property that the original private owner doesn't want to give up. Now, a good example of this, in my opinion, is West 57th Street in Manhattan, in which the state of New York condemned a great deal of private property in order to turn it over to CBS. Now, probably in retrospect, most New Yorkers are perfectly glad that CBS has that property, but in doing that, the state of New York did wipe out a pretty important industry, the perfume and essence industry, which had been on that property. And I think this kind of thing is very questionable.
Well, also the New York Times has used eminent domain law to build its new headquarters.
Absolutely.
The Atlantic Yards development in Brooklyn is using eminent domain law. And originally eminent domain law, you know, whether you like the state's purpose or not, was for government entities to take land they deem necessary for their operations. But in recent decades, it's been expanded so that it could benefit non-government actors. Isn't that the case?
Well, in 1949, the federal government passed what we call the Urban Renewal Law, and that is what really began the most aggressive use of eminent domain all over the country for private entities. In 1954, the Supreme Court upheld that in Berman versus Parker in upholding a Washington, pretty outrageous Washington, D.C. case in which property was taken from a black woman in southeast Washington. She had maintained her property perfectly well, but the area around her property was regarded as blighted, and the Urban Renewal Authority took her property and turned it over to a private developer. So that's really, you know, it's pretty recent stuff in terms of the history of the Republic that this kind of thing is allowed to happen.
And then, of course, there was a Supreme Court case a few years ago about New London, right? What was that all about?
Right, that was what was that? Was that last summer? I lose track of time, but it wasn't too long ago. I think it was about
it was a
year ago.
Year or two ago, yeah.
Well, what that was about was New London had a rather decrepit waterfront, but an attractive waterfront, as is often the case in these old industrial cities, in the sense that the water was really quite spectacular and could have been highly desirable if it weren't for the existence of some very modest homes. Now, some of the homes had deteriorated and some had not. But New London, which is a sort of middling city and has pretty serious financial problems, wanted to take the waterfront to turn over to the Pfizer Pharmaceutical Company and condemned or tried to take through eminent domain and did. Well, I'm hesitating here because I'm not sure that it's actually been completed, but the Supreme Court upheld New London's taking. There's another pretty outrageous case closer to home than New London, and that's this case in Portchester, in which the town of Portchester has turned over a section of Main Street to a private developer, which is allowed to condemn property in order to put in almost exactly that use. And that's a pretty outrageous case. Columbia is hoping to do something entirely different in the sense that their objection to the businesses that are there now is that they feel those businesses are incompatible with Columbia's academic mission, and they feel they need the entire footprint of their site to set up these major research facilities. So it's a little bit different.
I should say I'm speaking with Julia Vitullo-Martin, who is a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of an op-ed in the New York Post yesterday, which the 10 editors of the Post entitled Columbia's Greed, which she doesn't fully agree with. All right, so Columbia wants to expand north, and, you know, whether you like it or not, in our capitalist economy, if you want to expand, you write some checks and buy land from people. Now, Columbia is meeting with some resistance. There's people who don't want to sell, right?
Right.
So who are some of these people who don't want to sell to Columbia?
Well, the largest private property owner up there other than Columbia is a storage company, Tuck It Away. And they have five buildings, and Columbia wants four of them. The fifth building was landmarked as a very good, very interesting example of 19th century industrial architecture. So that's landmarked, and Columbia's not going after that because it doesn't want to take on the preservationists and all the difficulties of taking down a landmark building. But they do want Tuck It Away's other four buildings. And the owner of Tuck It Away, Nick Sprayragan, says, you know, this is a business started by his father, and it's a profitable business, and he serves the local community. So he says, you know, he can't easily be relocated because he has to be close to his customers. And he also makes some arguments about the importance of the wide streets to his business and to some of the other businesses up there. He says it's very hard to find a street in Manhattan with that kind of width. So he, you know, he's a perfectly legitimate private businessman, and this is a perfectly legitimate company, and he says it's his property, and he doesn't want to sell it. And I think, you know, that's his right as an American and as a New Yorker.
Now, you in general support Columbia's movement to Harlem. I suspect a lot of our listeners might not, but just give us your opinion of what Columbia can bring to the neighborhood.
Well, Columbia is the seventh largest private employer in New York, so they're a major employer. And, of course, they're a world-class university known everywhere, the equal in many fields to Princeton, Harvard, Penn, maybe better in some fields. And their expansion, their new academic center, will, among other things, create 6,900 very high-quality jobs, which, you know, are extremely important to New York.
One suspects that most of those jobs will not be filled by residents of Harlem, right?
Well, I think on this, Columbia is trying very, very hard to be a good neighbor. Now, there are many people who have a long history in the neighborhood who are skeptical of Columbia, but I think, in fact, they're trying very hard to be a good neighbor. They've set up an employment center on Broadway. They promise that many of the jobs will go, they have many jobs for local residents, and I think we should believe them. And the reason I think we should believe them is that this project is going to be watched very, very carefully. The community board up there, Community Board 9, is a very sophisticated community board. Columbia's made its promises, and the community board and local activists are likely to make sure that Columbia keeps the promises. So I think the jobs will benefit the neighborhood.
But of course, there's the case almost 40 years ago when Columbia tried to build a gym in Morningside Park that provoked fierce opposition. And as you concede in your piece, there's a lot of sort of class struggle involved in this, that people, darker and poorer people, see this mostly white and rich university trying to roll into their neighborhood and just kick them out. I mean, do you think the neighborhood has a legitimate grievance?
Well, first of all, we're talking about relatively small numbers in terms of residents on this site. So while I think you know, an American's home is a sacred thing, we're talking about only 132 apartments within this site. So residents are not getting kicked out. And of those 132, nearly all the residents on the site are in city-owned buildings. And the housing agency, HPD, has said repeatedly that if the city decides to sell these buildings to Columbia, that Columbia will have to replace the current apartments with equal or better apartments. And in other words, the city is promising that residents will be held harmless by this transaction. So this isn't an instance like New London in which the entity exercising eminent domain intends to take homes away from people. That is unlikely to happen.
But you make the point in the piece that city zoning laws have restricted parts of this neighborhood to industrial use for which there aren't very many takers.
Right.
So the state caused the blight in the first. What they caused the trouble in the first place, they'll pronounce it blight and then sweep it away.
Well, this is an ongoing problem in American cities. A very big problem here in New York, although it's something, by the way, in which the Bloomberg administration has been very good. Our zoning code was passed in 1961, so, you know, we have a very old zoning code for the city that covers neighborhoods that are very dynamic. I mean, New York is one of the most dynamic cities in the world. and we've got this old zoning code. Now, this section of Manhattan, West Harlem, does look to the naked eye like a underutilized, I am trying to not use the word blight because that's the official assessment word that can trigger eminent domain. Nonetheless, this property is underused, and it's underused because the industrial zoning has prevented normal development from happening in this neighborhood. So the normal residential development that would naturally be moving northward and southward got stopped in this particular neighborhood. And that's why this potential declaration of blight might come through.
Now, as I recall, Soho was once designated an industrial area. It then went through a period of transition where artists moved in, and now it's just nothing but celebrities and hedge fund artists. But how did that transformation of Soho happen? Was there a legal transformation of the zoning, or is it just sort of working around the law? What went on?
Well, Soho, you probably remember, had the oddity of the loft conversions. In the 60s and early 1970s, a huge number of residents moved in illegally because of the zoning, moved in to the old manufacturing lofts and lived in them. And they lived under, you know, pretty horrific conditions frequently because manufacturing buildings, especially 19th century and early 20th century manufacturing buildings, are not suitable to live in. So, you know, they have those huge industrial elevators, for example. So people moved in, many artists, but not exclusively artists, they moved in and revitalized the neighborhood, which had been pretty empty. Not entirely empty. There was, for example, pretty flourishing printing trade in the 1970s. But then, when the city was faced with the problem of all these illegal residents, and so the city worked with the state to pass the loft law. There is a remnant of this today. The loft board, which is made up of mayoral appointees, is trying to regularize all the illegal lofts all over the city, some of which still exist in Soho. I don't think we're going to see that particular phenomenon in West Harlem, though. There is one. There are a couple of lofts in this neighborhood, but that's one of those. For the most part, I think the illegal loft phenomenon in Manhattan is a thing of the past.
Well, and finally, let's just return to Columbia. What is likely to happen with the eminent domain? What's coming up in the coming weeks and months?
Well, Columbia's really got a lot on its plate right now because it has to get the area rezoned. Which is a major undertaking. And to start the land use review process, a draft environmental impact statement has to be completed. Columbia pays for that. The DEIS is supposed to be independent. Columbia pays for that. Meanwhile, the state, in anticipation of exercising eminent domain, has hired the same consultant as Columbia hired to make an assessment for the state of whether or not this area is actually blighted. So those two things are happening virtually simultaneously. When Columbia's draft environmental impact statement is completed and other things are in place, Columbia will apply probably in May to city planning, to start the land use review process, which is a 7-month process. And what then is going to happen is there are going to be many hearings, and I'm sure many demonstrations, and many op-eds and articles, and a great deal of controversy about this. And everything to do with the project will be discussed by the community board, by the city, by activists. It's going to be a very lively 7 months.
All right. Well, thank you for kicking off our discussion of this process. I've been speaking with Julia Vatullo-Martin, who is a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, an author of the Center for Rethinking Development's newsletter, and the op-ed Columbia's Greed, which is the Post title, not hers, appeared in yesterday's New York Post. And you can find a lot of her writing on the Manhattan Institute website, manhattan-institute.org, and look for Julia Vatullo-Martin, one of their scholars. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and don't forget that event up at Teachers College, the three economists talking about climate change, Nicholas Stern, Jeffrey Sachs, Joseph Stiglitz. That's next Wednesday, April 11th, 4 p.m., 147 Horace Mann Building, which is 525 West 120th Street between Broadway and Amsterdam. Open to the public, free. Everyone's welcome. And I will be recording it and hopefully broadcasting bits of it the following week. But you can hear the whole thing if you go in person. And let's go out with a bit more of the excerpts from Mahler's Das Lied von der Erde, conducted by Philip Paravega. Till next week, bye. Schlaf ich wieder.